Off the ball
on News Talk.
In association with the Air Sport app, allowing you to cast your favourite sporting action from your tablet or mobile phone straight to your TV.
I'm doing some work. I was up in the north doing a story basically 20 years after the Good Friday Agreement. Not a retrospective as much as where are they right now, blah, blah, blah. So I basically spent a lot of time talking to old provos and loyalists, people that used to kill people, and now they just kill time. But the other thing, and I don't want to say the A word, but that's what I'm doing. I'm doing something on the abortion referendum.
Okay.
So it's interesting because there were people from Massachusetts who were actually involved in the anti-movement, so the anti-repeal movement. So very interesting from a Boston perspective, but also a lot of people in Boston are intrigued or interested about the whole idea of the amendment and what will happen.
So is Boston as sports mad as ever? Because it's generally regarded as perhaps the most sports mad city in America, which is a pretty big statement.
I'd say, objectively speaking, I'd say it comes down to Boston and Chicago.
Okay.
Chicago people are kind of cuckoo.
Interesting. Another Irish stronghold.
Yes, exactly. The difference is Boston has been far more successful. There's been no city in America that has had more championships in the last 20 years. I'm trying to think when the Patriots won in 2002, and then the Red Sox broke the curse of 86 years, which gives heart to people in Clare. People in Mayo. Actually, the Clare Hurlers came when they finally won in the 90s. Mm. And it was a long time since Clare had won. And they came, and I actually hung around with the team. And of course, they were on the piss. And people in Boston took great comfort that if Clare could break their curse, clearly the Hurlers and Clare could break their curse. Eventually, the Red Sox did. It took us another 9 years. Mm. But the Red Sox broke the curse and won after 86-year drought in 2004. And then the Patriots kept winning Super Bowls, and the Red Sox won three championships between 2004 and 2014? So the year of the marathon bombing, whatever that was, 13, I guess. So the Patriots win five Super Bowls. Red Sox win three World Series championships. Celtics win a championship. Bruins win a Stanley Cup. Mm. And there's no other city in America that comes close. So in terms of, I think people in Chicago are just as passionate. It's like I always say, if you talk to somebody in Chicago or Boston about sports, even the little old grannies know about sports.
What's going on? Yeah.
If you go to places like New York, there's just such a diversity of people that you'd find people that was like, I don't know anything about this. Mm. But Boston and Chicago are the two towns. The real difference over the last 20 years is, you know, since the Bulls, Chicago haven't really, since that Jordan era when they won a bunch, they've not done anything. The Blackhawks have won at least two, if not three, Stanley Cups that I can think of in the last 20 years. And obviously the Cubs broke the curse.
Yeah.
And the White Sox won the World Series, I want to say 2007 or something like that. So Chicago has had some success, but probably half of what Boston has had.
And so if you take the Red Sox, the Bruins in ice hockey, the Celtics, mm-hmm. and obviously the Patriots, is there a commonly regarded people's team? Like, does the city home a little better if one of those is doing better than the other?
I think the town responds to all teams. The Bruins less, because hockey would be, if you go into the African American community, into the Hispanic communities, hockey just doesn't resonate the same way. There aren't many African American or Latino players in the National Hockey League. So it just doesn't resonate. But I think whether it's the Red Sox, the Celtics, or the Patriots, the entire city, and it's not even the city, it's like here. Dublin is not just a city, it's the greater Dublin area, just as the greater Boston area. You're talking about 3 million people, and they're all sports nuts, they're mad. And they're also unliked across the country because of the success. Boston fans have a reputation of being arrogant, and part of that is true.
Yeah.
Hubris comes with winning. And who could be more arrogant than Bill Belichick? I mean, nobody is more arrogant than him. And I think I know that certainly the Patriots are the most hated team in America. And their ratings are extraordinarily high in nationally televised games. But that means that 97% of the people who are turning in are watching to see them lose.
Yes.
So it's sort of like the anybody but United mentality.
Just actually, you know? Took the words out of my mouth. Yeah. During the 90s, that was alive and well.
Even and you know I'm a United supporter, yeah, so yeah, don't go there.
Even at England games with about five or six Manchester United players in the team, or certainly the squad, there was a stand-up if you hate Man U kind of a thing going on. Yeah. So we won't be able to play all of this out tonight, but we asked you, just for the hell of it, seeing as you're here in person, to pick out three Bostonian sports people. I know they're not all necessarily from Boston,
right?
But who have loomed large in Boston sports history. So you've done that for us in between going around to the pubs of Dublin. We appreciate that.
And you do your research one way. I do my research another.
You've sought out inspiration in the pubs of Dublin. So Ted Williams is who you're going to tell us about first. You say Williams, the greatest pure hitter of all time.
No question.
And a mercurial figure as well, Ted Williams. So he played basically for the guts of 20 years for the Red Sox between 1939 and 1960.
Yes. Last player to hit 400. It's one of those things, like with Joe DiMaggio's 56-game hitting streak. It will be extraordinary if that's ever equaled. What you have to do to hit 400 is just crazy. The other really interesting thing about Williams is that he lost 5 years of playing time because he served in both World War II and the Korean War. He was a Marine pilot, which is pretty extraordinary. And he flew a lot of combat missions. The fact that he got back here, I ended up meeting his wingman once, the guy that flew with him in Korea. And the guy was, he said, geez, Ted was quite a storyteller. He said, we'd be up there and he'd be talking to me, instead of talking about like combat stuff, he'd be talking about like Bob Feller throwing fastballs at his head. And the other thing that's really remarkable about Williams is that he was one of the staunchest advocates for integrating the game. And the Red Sox turned out to be the last team in baseball to do that. When they hired, the Red Sox had a shot. They had a tryout with Jackie Robinson in 1946, and it turned out it was a farce. The Red Sox didn't want to sign this. Pinky Higgins, the manager at the time, was an out-and-out racist, a virulent racist. And that issue is burning in Boston very strongly right now, because John Henry, who happens to own my newspaper, so he's my titular boss, and he also owns Liverpool Football Club, and he also owns the Boston Red Sox. John Henry announced that he wants to remove the name Yawkey Way, which is the main drag that goes up through the Red Sox Fenway Park, because he believes that Yawkey was a racist, and he thinks it tarnishes the legacy of the Boston Red Sox. It's a big hullabaloo, because some people want it to remove the name, and a lot of other people think that the racist rap on Yawkey is unfair and exaggerated. And it's the Yawkey Foundation is one of the biggest philanthropic organizations in Boston, and most of their money is put into either medical care, cancer care, but most of it is actually put into minority communities. And the board is run by an awful lot of people, including Reverend Ray Hammond, a friend of mine, who's an African-American minister, who was very opposed to taking the Yawkey name off. So it's very controversial, but I would love to know what Ted Williams thought about that, because, again, Williams was ahead of his time. He was a big supporter of the Negro Leagues, which is when baseball was segregated. And he said that Satchel Paige was the greatest pitcher he ever saw. And he said Larry Doby was one of the most underrated players. He just had a good heart. He was way ahead of his time.
Where was he from, Ken?
He was from San Diego.
Okay.
And he was just a pure... He was the first person to approach hitting as a science. And he did put, like, scientific methodology into the way he hit. And basically, he defined the strike zone in his head as... And he actually, I remember as a kid, I got a book that he wrote, and it was about he would have the plate where the ball came over, and then he would identify these zones where if he got the ball here, he hit 480. If he hit it on the outside of the plate, which is a pitcher's pitch, and down and away, he hit 230. And he approached this like no one had ever, I mean, frankly, baseball players were uneducated, and very often just ignorant of anything like that. Ted Williams, again, he was a scientist. He was the first baseball player that approached hitting as the art of science and the art of hitting. And he wasn't much of an outfielder. The other thing about Ted Williams, I remember one of his fans telling me this when we were working on, of all things, the Whitey Bulger story about the gangster and trying to portray him. Billy Bulger, the politician, was a great fan of Ted Williams and described of how he got a autograph from him when he was about 12 years old. And he said, I thought Billy said it very well. He said, Ted Williams would, he could be in a stadium where 39,000 people were cheering him, and Ted would hear the one who was booing.
That's an interesting point, because as I understand it, Williams famously had a complicated relationship with fans, to the point where I was just even reading this afternoon, he stopped tipping his cap after home runs, became almost a stoic, cold figure on the field, Ted Williams, in spite of his brilliance. So that's quite a difficult one for the fans to navigate.
Well, again, this goes to his personality that was very mercurial. So he didn't like that some fans booed him. And so he basically, his punishment was to treat all fans with disdain. And he treated sports writers worse. He was notorious for basically having, I think he had fist fights with some of them, but he wouldn't talk to some guys. And he was the sort of, and again, he was the first superstar that started doing that.
As I saw, he maintained a career-long feud with Sport Magazine, I presume, a pretty big deal. Yeah. A career-long feud with him. So we're talking about a guy who started playing in 39 through to 1960. So in 1948, he said, I ain't speaking with you guys anymore, because they had a quote from his mother, probably innocuous enough, but he felt his private life was private.
That was the kind of guy he was. And there's a great, there's some great images when the Red Sox, I was actually living in Ireland at the time. In 1999, the Red Sox hosted the All-Star game at Fenway Park, and they wheeled Ted Williams out onto the field. And all the greatest players in the game came up and embraced him individually. And one of the most moving ones was Tony Gwynn, who was a terrific hitter. Tony died, sadly, very young. He was and Tony was the one that came closest to hitting 400. I think he hit 380-something one year.
And what is 400 for a day?
A 400 would be, if you get up 10 times, that means you get four hits. Again, baseball is one of the few sports in which the greatest players fail 70% of the time at the plate. It's very unusual like that. So anyway, Tony Gwynn, basically, the embrace was really long. And people asked Tony Gwynn after, he said, I feel like I'm standing here because of Ted Williams. That my dad, particularly, I think he met his dad, because his dad was a pro ball player and was one of the, he would have been in the first 5 or 6 years of when baseball was integrated. So, I mean, the love that Tony Gwynn had for him was really true and pure. And Tony came up to Boston for the memorial service when Ted died. And then Ted's death, even in death, I mean.
When did he die?
Oh, God, you'd have to tell me. I forget. It was a long time ago, sometime in the 2000s, early 2000s, I think. But his son, John, John Henry, it's funny enough, that's his name, John Henry Williams. John missed his dad so much and longed for his dad so much that they decapitated Ted Williams and froze his head. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. And then poor John gets sick with cancer and dies very young. I always thought it would be a hell of a biopic.
Is the head still frozen?
The head is still frozen.
Where is it?
It's in some laboratory in Arizona.
Why?
My wife told me she's going to put me in there. She said, you can be next to Ted. You're a hero. You can be with Ted Williams.
Well, there you go. So is he heroic and, dare I say it, loved in spite of the atmosphere with the fans?
I think anybody like me, this guy was my hero. I never saw him play a game. He played his last game when I was 2 years old. And by the way, adding to the legend, last at bat, home run.
So why is he
42 years old?
Why is he your hero then?
Just because of when I was a kid, I read books about baseball. I was actually a crap player. Good glove, no hit. That's what they used to call me. Good glove, no hit. I could catch anything. I was fast, but I couldn't hit a curveball. I was terrible. In fact, my nickname on my American Legion team, it was to make an American Legion team, that's like after high school. So between high school and college, you have to be a pretty good ball player. And I remember Mr. Lockhart, the coach, picked me, and all the other kids said, "Cullen sucks, he can't hit." And by Johnny Furlong, the shortstop, nicknamed me after the third game was, when you strike out, they put a K in the scorebook. So my nickname became Special K, like the cereal.
Yeah.
I think I struck out 70 times that season. I was just horrible. My average, I think I hit 180 something.
Yeah.
So
Williams is obviously...
But Williams is, he's just he's a legendary player, a legendary man. He was a warrior. I mean, I just don't, there's
nothing...
Is it
the war hero stuff?
Was a war hero. He genuinely, I mean, he flew a lot of combat missions and shot down a number of Japanese fighter jets during the Second World War. I mean, he's an extraordinary guy.
Did he soften post-retirement open himself up a bit more?
He did. And it's funny because we're going to talk about Bill Russell after. Same thing. Bill Russell had a very diffident, contentious relationship with fans and writers and all that stuff. They're very similar. I don't know. I don't think they ever met.
Right.
But I think that Ted Williams and Bill Russell would have really got on.
Yeah. Okay, their mutual disdain for
exactly. They said
the
they would know what it's like to be great and have to deal with all these arseholes.
Yeah, he never won a World Series. Obviously, with the 86 years and the curse and everything, he played in one World Series and they lost that.
Yeah.
So, why
1946?
Why was Williams not picked up by the Yankees or someone?
That was back in an era nobody you were with the team for life.
Okay.
That was before free agency. Free agency came in the 1970s.
So was he kind of stuck with them, whether he liked it
sort of. I mean, there were trades. The most famous trade was when the Red Sox unloaded a very good pitcher named Babe Ruth to the New York Yankees, which began the curse.
Yeah.
But no, the other thing about Ted Williams is David Halberstam, who was one of our greatest journalists and writers, wrote a book called The Teammates. And he was very close with Dom DiMaggio, who was Joe DiMaggio's brother, and obviously played it. Dom DiMaggio was a great player. He was not his brother, but he played, I mean, he was an all-star. He was a terrific player. The other guy was Johnny Pesky. And Johnny Pesky was very unfairly labeled as, there was in the 1946 series, on basically a single, Enos Slaughter for the Cardinals kept running. He never stopped. And Johnny went out to the outfield and took the cutoff throw. And then he looked too late. By this time, Slaughter had rounded third and was heading for home. Pesky threw the ball, and he beat the throw. Mm. And there was always the rap, Pesky held the ball, instead of Havlicek stole the ball, which was the famous call for basketball. Pesky held the ball. And Ted was very defensive. And when writers would bring that up, he would bite their heads off. Mm. Very defensive, Johnny Pesky. And the third player that was very close to him was a guy named Bobby Doerr, Hall of Famer. One of the lowest hitting Hall of Famers of all time. I think his average was about .283, but he was a terrific defensive player. But basically, he made the Hall of Fame because everybody in baseball said Bobby Doerr made everybody around him better. And he's just a class guy. He just recently died, Bobby. And I wrote a story about when he came back to Fenway Park for the last time, I had lunch with him and Pesky, and they talked about their wives. And Ted, I think, had three marriages. And Ted, his best friends, Dom DiMaggio, Johnny Pesky, and Bobby Doerr were married to the same women their whole lives. And when I totaled up the years that they were married to these women, it was like 175 years. It was crazy. They were married, all of them were married for like 60 years. And Johnny's Ruthie, he said, "My Ruthie died 2 years ago and I miss her every day." And Dom DiMaggio's wife, Marion, she's a doll. Dom was sick, he couldn't come up. He was confined to basically a wheelchair at home. And then, Bobby Doerr's wife, what was her name? Evie? Bobby Doerr's wife had died recently too, and they had been married for like 68 years. They're just extraordinary human beings beyond their baseball ability. And William, and the fact that those good, solid guys were friends with Ted Williams, and he was fiercely protective of him. It was just another part of the Williams lore that this crazy, mercurial guy would have the most stable, decent guys in the locker room as his friends.
You can judge people by their friends sometimes.
I mean, I agree.
That's a sign. Yeah. So, and I know he got the Presidential Medal of Freedom in '91 from George Bush.
He did.
So, a final point on Williams, is he like revered to this day? Are there Ted Williams statues around Fenway? Is it that kind
there
of thing?
There is a Ted Williams statue outside of Gate B in Fenway Park. Yeah, I think Williams is one of those guys that, because people that didn't like him for the mercurial start, because they've all died off like him, his reputation has been rehabilitated. The bottom line is, anybody who's a serious baseball fan will tell you he was the greatest hitter of all time. No one has come close. No one has been able to match the average with the power. Usually when you're a power hitter, your average suffers because you're taking big cuts. You're not just going for singles, dinking the ball. Yeah. You're trying to hit the ball out of the ballpark.
What was Babe Ruth?
Babe Ruth, in terms of what, he was both. He was a high average hitter. He was a 300 hitter.
Williams was a 400 hitter.
One season he hit 400. His career average, off the top of my head, I don't know what it was.
Ruth never managed 400 a season, did he?
No, he never hit 400.
Right.
And the other thing about the home run numbers, 521 for Ted Williams, he lost five full seasons.
With the wars.
Yeah. And those were his prime years.
Right.
So you average, I think he averaged about 40 home runs. There's another 200 home runs. He hit 721 home runs, which is five more than Babe Ruth.
Okay.
And he didn't take steroids.
Yeah, which, you know, can't be said for everyone, to say the very least. Thanks for telling us about Ted Williams. We are going to play out another night, you talking to us about Bill Russell and Bobby Orr. But Kevin Cullen, enjoy Dublin.
Good man. Thanks, brother. Good to see you.
Off the Ball.
On News Talk. In association with the Air Sport app, allowing you to cast your favourite sporting action from your tablet or mobile phone straight to your TV.